Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open our show with a special report from El Cajon, where we met with volunteers helping set up a home for a refugee family from Afghanistan. Hear how community members are pitching in to welcome these newcomers and the steep challenges that they're facing. In honor of Veterans Day, the Hamul Casino made a donation to help deported veterans. Supervisor Nathan Fletcher spoke there, along with the Hamul tribal leader, a deported veteran, and an advocate fighting to get help for immigrants who served our country in the armed forces only to face deportation. Santee dedicated a new veterans memorial on Veterans Day, and we'll have details on today's show. Then on Crime Beat, hear about a suspect wanted for a savage knife attack on an elderly man near an El Cajon trolley station. Plus, hear how many weapons were turned in at a Guns for Gifts Cards event hosted by law enforcement in La Mesa. San Diego County supervisors have received a letter threatening a lawsuit over their recent action to limit public speaking in response to threatening and racist comments made during a recent meeting. Find out why Attorney Corey Briggs says supervisors went too far and that the new ordinance violates constitutional rights as well as California's open government law. Redistricting commissions have released maps showing proposed new supervisorial, state legislative, and congressional district maps for our region, but many East County leaders are objecting to proposals that they say would carve up East County and potentially weaken rural and East County voices. We'll have details on this important story on today's show. It's open enrollment time for the Affordable Care Act. Find out how you can get more information on health care options later on today. November is Senior Pet Adoption Month, and the San Diego Humane Society is offering half-price adoptions of senior pets at all of its facilities, including El Cajon and East County. From Public News Service, we'll have some top national and international news stories today, including highlights from the Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Then we'll have a report on a complaint filed by immigrants advocates accusing the Border Patrol of ignoring urgent humanitarian parole applications for individuals and families with severe medical needs, including babies who are seriously ill. Lemon Grove has a food drive coming up for its city residents, including turkeys, just in time for Thanksgiving. The county has convened a panel of experts to address COVID facts and myths, and we'll have some of their findings on today's show. And finally, with the holiday season fast approaching, we'll have some holiday trivia facts for you to share at your next holiday gathering. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Recently, East County Magazine stopped by an apartment in El Cajon, where volunteers from Helping El Cajon Refugees were hard at work to transform the empty space into a welcoming place for a newly arrived Afghan family. Moving in were Sarah, her husband, who worked with the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan, and their daughters, 4-month-old Sanaa and 3-year-old Asra. Steered by Jill Galante and Peggy Hahn, this volunteer effort has organized to address the needs locally of incoming refugee populations for over 5.5 years. The bulk of their recent capacity has been thrust toward welcoming the influx of Afghans who have fled their home in the wake of the Taliban takeover. Currently headquartered on a Facebook page, the group is pulling together donations and getting them where they are most needed around the clock. The night prior to moving in Sara, they were delivering mattresses to a family of 10. While scanning a newly assembled single bedroom, now ready for 4 people, Galante spoke about how the group tries to make each apartment as homely as possible to lessen the stress of the ever-evolving situation.
On top of the move-ins, what we're dealing with is an unprecedented amount of refugees who are arriving here with literally nothing.
Yeah.
The clothes that they are wearing is all they were able to escape with. The caseworkers are so overloaded.
The stakes are high, she adds.
We regularly, 4 and 5 times a day, get messages saying, please, my family is so hungry. Please, can you go visit?
Sara's is one of many Afghan families that took a gamble at the Hamid Karzai International Airport as the window for evacuation was waning in late August. And they were four of the 50,000 who still awaited processing in eight military bases across the country. Until now, as they watched Helping El Cajon Refugees, or HECR, finalize their new apartment. In the weeks following the August 15th seizure of Kabul, the gaze of American news media was decidedly glued to Afghanistan's capital. Yet since the United States military officially left the country on August 30th, less and less mass attention is being given to the Afghan people, despite the surge in refugees at America's doorstep who need and deserve American help. Resettlement agencies and grassroots aid organizations working in East County, such as HECR, are doing all they can to house, feed, and clothe arriving Afghan families, with hopes of setting them up for long-term success in this strange new place. But doing so is proving to be a steep uphill battle with the highest of consequences. East County Magazine offers this extended report, where we'll look at the local developments in this international story. While this is not the first time San Diego County has been an epicenter for people seeking refuge from violence, the current moment is hitting a new decibel of intensity for both refugees and those in positions to help. Most Afghans have come into the United States as special immigrant visa holders, parolees, or under humanitarian protection. Very few come to the country independently or with no ties here. Upon arrival in San Diego, people either seek out short-term housing with someone they know or get assigned to one of four local resettlement agencies. In some cases, the latter can lead to marginalization at an extended stay hotel or Airbnb while the agency scrambles to find permanent housing. HECR gets information from those caseworkers as well as from their own network, so they know how best to help. During the move-in, Galante explained further.
Their SIMs don't work, so they don't have phones. They don't have food. They don't have social security numbers, so they can't get SNAP and they can't get cash aid. And they are just like in a holding pattern.
She then gestured to the filled apartment around her.
So to be able to do this just saves them one out of the 100 traumas they're going to have to deal with.
During the first half of 2021, the new Afghan arrival numbers for the entire region were below 20 people each month. As the summer unfolded into the fall, though, that trend began to shoot upwards. It last peaked in October at 560 people, according to the latest report by the San Diego Refugee Forum. Several thousand more are expected to come to the United States in the coming weeks, but just how many will end up in San Diego remains unknown. In an interview with East County Magazine, Donna Duvin, the executive director of the San Diego International Rescue Committee chapter, said, quote, "It's all happening at a pretty rapid clip." She explained how in the past, agencies have had up to 2 weeks to prepare support, but right now are working with just 24 to 48 hours notice of when individuals are heading their way. With that turnaround time, the IRC assisted 181 refugees in San Diego from September 1st to October 25th. Duvin put that in perspective, noting how, quote, "That compares to 170 total refugees that we were able to support in the entire fiscal year previously, so it definitely has a different pace." To make matters harder, resettlement agencies are still recovering from the Trump administration, which put in place policies that damaged their capacity, slashed resources, and made refugee support a partisan issue, despite an all-time high of 26 million refugees worldwide. Things were improving in mid-August as revived federal support approached with the October 1st fiscal year. And then the crisis happened. East County Magazine also spoke with Atleva Bezhko, Director of Refugee and Immigration Services at Jewish Family Service. She recalled how, quote, "It caught us totally unprepared to support those numbers." She added that, quote, "We are building capacity as we are serving the clients." Lucky for these long-standing agencies, their internal foundations remained and can be ramped back up over time. Still, the dire circumstances underscore their need for more in-kind, financial, and volunteer support. From Bezhko's standpoint, the current pace and numbers are exposing weaknesses in the system. Families have been stuck on military bases for months in a backlog of slow-moving processing requirements. Before anyone can leave a base, they must pass medical and criminal background checks, get fully vaccinated, complete a quarantine, and coordinate a plan for travel. In addition, only those with a United States tie are being let off the bases. In Sarah's case, her family only made it to the U.S. and left the Fort Lee Army Base with the help of Mohammed Fahim Hamidi, an acquaintance from Afghanistan who came to America himself 3 years ago. He and Sarah's husband briefly worked in the same warehouse that was contracted with the U.S. Embassy, but it was enough. At Sarah's move-in, he commented on this work.
Yeah, if you have just a high and vibe with somebody over there, if he comes here, he is like your brother here. Because you don't know anybody else here.
Yeah.
Hamidi has helped many friends and former co-workers leave Afghanistan and get settled in California, actively partnering with HECR. Still, connecting with a loose tie is more often than not a temporary step towards what has proven to be the biggest challenge for Afghans coming to San Diego: finding affordable, safe, and permanent housing. In the past, employment was the bigger issue, with refugees finding success in forming pockets of community, particularly in El Cajon and City Heights. But today, housing is the principal need in the resettlement process. Until finding employment, Afghans are living off of a one-time federal emergency appropriation of $1,225 per person. They can qualify for additional aid like the CalFresh program, but the wait time is a 3-week minimum. And even if they find a vacancy and can devote their budget solely to housing, keeping up with the rent will be a challenge. Bejko voiced her familiarity with this issue, as it is a statewide California challenge. She commented that, quote, "In addition to availability, it's also the new property managers." She continued, explaining how property managers still require high credit scores and proof of income that is double or triple rent, things refugees can seldom provide right away. Ironically, refugees can become some of the most reliable tenants in the face of these barriers, especially in El Cajon. Bejko, who has overseen the placement of thousands of people in East County, stated that, quote, "The rate of clients being evicted because they are not paying is very low." She continued, saying how, quote, "That community was built over years, with language and cultural capacity to provide services." Indeed, El Cajon has accessible schools, walkable streets, caring and knowledgeable mentors, and strong pre-existing networks of support. It can make a world of difference to live there, and many Afghan, Iraqi, and Syrian newcomers seek it out and stay. Yet the housing shortage is constricting this option. Families are ending up miles away in places like Escondido or even placed in other states. Sarah and her family were first only offered resettlement in Alaska. It was their connection to Hamidi in San Diego that enabled them to come to California instead. Efforts have been made to address the gaping housing need, such as a $3,200 Airbnb incentive for property owners to subsidize refugee housing. But Galante explained the nuance of this measure at the move-in.
Most of the legitimate Airbnbs didn't want to be a part of it because they make so much money. So these slums became Airbnbs overnight.
Okay,
we have called the property manager and they're like, "There's 10 people that want this apartment. Take it or leave it." I'm like, "Take it." You know? The gouging that's going on right now is disgusting, you know?
Sarah and her children stood together outside during the move-in while volunteers put the finishing touches on their apartment. We asked her about her hopes for her children and her feelings about leaving home. Hamidi translated her response.
She wants them to do their education. To become a good person, like achieve their goals.
They continued to speak.
So she's missing her parents. Since they came out of the army camp from Fort Lee, they couldn't talk with them because they have no phone or internet.
Hamidi also commented how
most Afghans whose families are left behind there, they don't have like peace of mind.
On top of the political turmoil, a drought, and the pandemic, Afghanistan is facing an economic crisis. Bank withdrawals and international transfers have been restricted. Assets are frozen and work is scant, according to a recent Reuters report. Sarah and her immediate family may have escaped the darkening situation back home, and they do have a housing success story here for now. But the journey ahead is still murky. Hamidi voiced how,
like right now they really need a job. Their utility expenses, food, and all this stuff. Like we applied for his benefits through county, but it's not approved yet. So they like right now I'm helping them with food and everything.
He continued.
Even the county, when we ask them to expedite the process for their car work and stuff, they are not doing it like they are doing it in normal process.
Looming beyond finding employment is the myriad of cultural adjustments to make. Just understanding the banking, healthcare, and school systems in America, and the language they function in, not to mention unpacking trauma once survival mode has lessened, all takes longer than the 90 days agencies have to provide immediate support. Bejko expressed how, quote, longer-term case management would make it easier for clients to actually start on the path towards integration because they are here to stay. Existing helping hands on that path include the Afghan Community Culture Center and the Islamic Center of San Diego. And while groups like Jewish Family Service, the IRC, and HECR are collaborating to scour the area for open housing, resettlement work does not stop there. Taking it to the necessary level of building long-term sustainability requires the whole community's engagement. For instance, the more value that can be gathered through in-kind donations, the more federal aid money refugees can spend elsewhere as they transition to living here. But the needs of resettlement are specific, and quality must be high. Items must be in new or like-new condition. People need bunk beds, mattresses, warm clothes, baby formula, and medicine, not bags of tattered hand-me-downs. For more information about donations, visit the International Rescue Committee's Amazon wishlist and learn how to further help them at www.rescue.org. Read Jewish Family Services' statement and consider donating and volunteering at www.jfssd.org. To join Helping El Cajon Refugees and get involved, look them up on Facebook. For additional information, refer to the San Diego Refugee Forum and the County Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. City governments can also step up in stride with their communities. In the midst of finishing up the details on Sarah's new apartment, down to quarters for the laundromat, stuffed animals, flowers, and welcome letters from school children, Galante asked for more care from those in the county and city charged with oversight.
And there's such a flood of money going to the country, to the state of California, to the county of California.
She went on to ask,
like, why aren't we incentivizing landlords? Why haven't you come and done one move-in to see what needs to be done, where the money might need to go?
Right.
Why aren't you following or shadowing a caseworker for the day to see where you would place your line items in a meaningful way? Or are we just going to hire people for $210,000 to have three meetings a month and take meticulous notes? Because that's what those meetings are. You will say, hey, guys, we've got people like starving. What are you doing? They'll be like, insightful. Noted. Absolutely noted. And you're like, okay, well, they can't eat, noted.
The bottom line is clear. Afghans are risking it all to get here, to start over in East County. And following up on the rush of headlines from August with tangible actions and quality resources today is a must for all public institutions, local governments, and residents. Bejko felt much the same. She finished the interview by saying, quote, this is not going to end tomorrow. It's not in the media anymore, but we are at it still. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
In honor of Veterans Day, the Hamul Casino has donated $10,000 to help deported veterans. Casino President and General Manager Mary Cheeks presented the check to John Rumman, a project coordinator with Unified United States Deported Veterans, during a luncheon to honor vets at the casino's rooftop venue. Erica Pinto, chairwoman of the Hamul Indian Village, commended the organization for serving as a resource for deported veterans.
The organization is dedicated to advocating for and assisting U.S. veterans who face deportation. It serves as a resource for deported veterans, assisting them in integrate into their new community while searching for legal avenues to return home to the U.S.
Also at the event was Nathan Fletcher, chairman of the County Board of Supervisors and a Marine Corps vet who served two combat tours. Fletcher also founded the Honorably Discharged, Dishonorably Deported Advocacy Group. Fletcher told the crowd,
you know, we always say everyone comes home. That's like a guiding principle, everyone comes home. But the reality is hundreds of our honorably discharged veterans and those who served in uniform, they came home, and then after their service, we deported them.
Undocumented immigrants are promised citizenship in exchange for military service, but too often, they never get that opportunity. Rumman explained how in 1996, Congress passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Responsibility Act, which allowed veterans to be deported regardless of their service.
They don't give a damn, you know, and they don't care if you got a Bronze Star or a Purple Heart.
Since 2007, the group's advocacy work has sought to change the congressional legislation because the 1996 law took the power out of the command of the courts. Yet Ruman and others have been at it for 14 years and say they've seen little federal support. Ruman says there are about 300 veterans who have been deported to Mexico that he's aware of.
Yeah, I know guys that have been down there for 20-plus years. Guys that have died down there.
Most deportations are caused by minor offenses that attract attention from ICE, and no judge or jury can stop them because of the current law. Ruman condemned this low bar for deportation.
We know 20% of the kids that came home from Iraq and Afghanistan, just what the DOD says, are suffering from post-traumatic stress. Another 20% with traumatic brain injury. They shouldn't be deported.
Also addressing the crowd was Robert Vivar, the organization's co-director, who was based in Tijuana and spoke via Zoom. Vivar was deported there in 2013 after living in the United States since he was 6 years old. But this Veterans Day, he was repatriated back into the United States.
And we feel that when a person took that oath of enlistment, when they raised it right hand, they proved beyond doubt their loyalty and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and should be considered a national, if not a citizen.
He takes issue with those who call the matter an immigration issue.
They say it's an immigration issue. I beg to differ. It is a veterans issue. How do you tell somebody that when they join the military, they're a U.S. national when they deploy overseas, and then when they come home, they are deportable?
In addition to the $10,000 donation to help deported veterans, Hamul Casino also honored 36 employees and 4 tribal members who are veterans with certificates and gift bags. They have served across the Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marine Corps. Special applause was held for Vietnam veterans and for Indigenous women veterans. Supervisor Fletcher praised the service of tribal members.
There is a rich and honorable service amongst our Native American communities when it comes to stepping up for a country that often does not deserve the appreciation that it gets back. Our Native American allies have served in the United States Armed Forces at 5 times the national average. They have fought in every war our country has been a part of. 27 Native Americans have been awarded the Medal of Honor.
Ruman thanked the tribe for honoring deported veterans, adding,
"Something their country has failed to do."
To Ruman, slogans such as "support the troops" and "honor our veterans" aren't meaningful as long as men and women who served our country in the armed forces remain deported. He concludes,
"It rings hollow to me."
Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
A new veterans memorial was dedicated in Santee on Veterans Day. Mayor John Minto and Santee Chamber of Commerce CEO Kristen Dare were on hand to also dedicate a bridge over Santee Lakes on Mast Boulevard, which is now called the Veterans Memorial Bridge. The ceremony attracted hundreds of guests, including many veterans from as far back as World War II, who watched with pride as the Marine Honor Guards presented flags accompanied by the Emerald Society San Diego Firefighters Pipes and Drums Band. The memorial structure was designed and built by Councilman Dustin Trotter and by Michael Ranson to honor veterans of all branches of the armed services. It measures 11 feet in height, width, and length in honor of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of the year when World War I ended, Armistice Day. Ever since, our nation has honored its veterans, and the ribbon cutting in Santee was held fittingly at 11 a.m. on November 11th to honor those who served in our nation's armed forces. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ in Santee, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Marie Johnson with a Crime Beat report. El Cajon police are asking for help to locate Israel Ezekiel Valdiva, who was wanted for the vicious stabbing of a 71-year-old man near the Ardell Avenue trolley stop on November 3rd, shortly after 5 a.m. According to Lieutenant Randy Soulard, the assault was an unprovoked attack on a stranger. The victim, Jose Serra, suffered major stab wound injuries to major organs, his head, hand, and stomach. The attack nearly severed his ear and cut an artery, causing major blood loss. Serra told ABC 10 News that the assailant asked him for directions to Spring Valley on the trolley. Later, after both men got off the trolley in El Cajon and Serra started walking toward his workplace at a nearby warehouse, Serra said that the attacker just pulled out the knife and started slashing. Investigators are looking into whether the assault on Serra, who is Filipino, may have been a hate crime. Surveillance video helped authorities identify the alleged attacker as Israel Ezequiel Valdiva, who had recently been released early from prison after serving just 6 months for assault with a deadly weapon. He has a long criminal history that include arrests or convictions for crimes including elder abuse, assault, possession of a dirk or dagger, robbery, escaping from custody, as well as numerous drug and theft charges. Valdiva is described as Hispanic. He has many tattoos, including a large V tattoo on his face. He is 5 feet 11 inches tall, weighs about 180 pounds, and has black hair and brown eyes. He is considered armed and dangerous. If you see him or know of his whereabouts, call 911. You can also call El Cajon Police or leave a tip and remain anonymous through Crime Stoppers. Valdiva is believed to frequent San Diego and Chula Vista and asked directions to Spring Valley just before attacking Serra. Serra's friend Todd Jones has set up a GoFundMe account to help Serra, who recently lost his job as a janitor and had suffered health problems before the attack. Jones hired Serra to do odd jobs at a warehouse, which he was on his way to when he was savagely attacked. Jones says of the effort to help Serra pay for his medical bills and other expenses, "With no family in San Diego, we take it upon ourselves to see him through this tragedy."
Nearly 300 unwanted guns were turned in on November 13th in La Mesa as part of a Guns for Gift Cards exchange program run by the San Diego County Sheriff's Department in partnership with local law enforcement agencies. The weapons were turned in during an event at the La Mesa Civic Center parking lot next to the police station, where people received a $100 gift card for each handgun, rifle, or shotgun turned in, and a $200 gift card for every assault weapon. The guns collected will be processed, and if any were involved in crimes, they'll be turned over to the appropriate law enforcement agencies. If any were stolen, they will be returned to the owners. All remaining guns will be destroyed in accordance with the law. A press release from the Sheriff's Department states, "Thank you to the public for helping us keep their communities safe by getting unwanted firearms off our streets." Now, you can always turn in unwanted weapons at any sheriff's station or substation, but keep the gun in the trunk of your vehicle until after you speak with a deputy. For more information on this, you can call the sheriff's non-emergency line at 858-565-5200. That number again is 858-565-5200. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We must accelerate climate action to keep alive the goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. It's time to go into emergency mode.
COP26 closed with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres hailing the compromise it reached. About 200 countries adopted the Glasgow Climate Pact. They plan to return next year with updates on emission cuts by 2030 and climate financing for developing nations. President of the summit, Alex Sharma of Britain, was troubled that the agreement pledged to phase down coal, not phase it out, after opposition from China and India.
To all delegates, I apologize for the way this process has unfolded, I'm deeply sorry. I also understand the deep disappointment. But I think, as you have noted, it's also vital that we protect this package.
Back here in the States, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other progressives argue the plan is not ambitious enough.
I don't think it's sunk in for a lot of people. A lot of people may not know this. We're living our day-to-day lives, but the stakes here are really huge.
Republicans question the agreement's impact on energy sector jobs with a move away from fossil fuels. Environmental groups are blasting a Biden administration plan to auction drilling rights in the Gulf of Mexico. Oil companies can bid Wednesday on nearly 80 million acres of federal waters that could produce a billion barrels of oil over 50 years. Opponents say Biden is breaking his pledge to ban new oil and gas leasing on public lands. Vice President Kamala Harris wrapped up a trip to Paris by placing flowers at a memorial to victims of a terror attack. She said the partnership between U.S. and France remains strong.
This trip was about, of course, making clear the longstanding relationship, but also that as we go into a new era for the world, that our work will continue, and we do it with a sense of optimism.
Harris sought to mend relations wounded when a submarine deal with Australia sidelined a prior deal with France. President Joe Biden will sign the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill today. 13 House Republicans joined most Democrats to pass the bill, while 6 Democrats and 200 Republicans were opposed. Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney, who helped negotiate the measure, weighed in on the lack of GOP support.
Some people thought, well, President Biden said he wanted to do something on a bipartisan basis. And so when we did something on a bipartisan basis, why, it looks like a victory for him. And some good Republicans say, I don't want to give him a victory.
Congress returns from break this week with the House focused on passing Biden's safety net climate and tax package. The Senate will shift its attention to the long overdue National Defense Authorization Act. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Earlier this month, San Diego County supervisors voted to enact changes to public speaking rules in an effort to address racist and threatening comments made at a recent public meeting. But the new policy not only authorizes the chair to admonish speakers who violate rules of civility, it also goes farther, eliminating the public's ability to ask that consent calendar items be fully discussed, restricting speaking times, and prohibiting group presentations on some topics. Supervisors' actions were triggered when Jason Robo made public comments during a meeting suggesting that one supervisor should be hung off a tree, wished harm on a second supervisor, and called the county's public health officer, who is Black, an Aunt Jemima. The speaker was one of an increasing number of public participants who have disrupted meetings with shouting and abusive remarks. But any road to limiting free speech is fraught with pitfalls, given First Amendment rights and state laws mandating access for citizens to speak at public meetings. Now, attorney Corey Briggs has sent supervisors a letter on behalf of the Project for Open Government threatening legal action unless the county revises the policy. While condemning the abusive comments recently made in a public meeting, Briggs contends that the new law violates state and federal constitutional rights, as well as California's open government requirements under the Ralph M. Brown Act. Here's what the ordinance does if it takes effect this week as planned. It requires that a statement be read at each meeting on the county's policy regarding discrimination and harassment, allows adoption of a code of civil discourse developed by the National Conflict Resolution Center, prohibits disruptive conduct, including but not limited to loud or threatening language, whistling, clapping, stamping of feet, speaking over or interrupting a speaker, allows the chair to interrupt and admonish a speaker who violates the rules, limits public speakers to just 1 minute each if there are 10 or more speakers on an issue, limits group presentation to only land use or adjudicatory matters, and cuts down the time each group member may speak. The new ordinance also eliminates the public's right to ask that an item be pulled off a consent calendar for a full presentation and discussion. Plus, it limits speakers to 2 minutes, no matter how many consent calendar items they may wish to address. It requires members of the public to bring their own technology to provide presentations, which could prevent those without a portable computer from making a presentation at all. It also takes one step to increase public access by allowing the public the option of continuing to participate remotely in meetings. Here are the arguments for and against the policy changes. Supervisors Nathan Fletcher, Nora Vargas, and Tara Lawson-Reamer voted for the changes. Supervisor Jim Desmond was not present due to a pre-planned trip. Supervisor Joel Anderson voted against. Anderson stated, "I condemn the racist and outrageous comments that have been made at past board meetings," but he added, "It is unfair to restrict people who have driven long distances to just 1 minute to address their elected officials on issues that affect their lives." He added, "We're allowing the heckler's voice to force our hand to shut down legitimate input." Fletcher said the action was needed to, quote, "ensure we can have a safe and healthy environment to conduct the people's business while allowing full public participants," adding, "it's now time for us to get back to work on the real issues our region faces." Civil rights leader Shane Harris, president of the People's Association of Justice Advocates, praised the majority of supervisors for passing the policy, but wants the county to go farther, requesting a review of the statements made by Robo to determine if they overstepped freedom of speech rights. He says racial incitement put county employees and attendees in harm's way, adding, "ensuring that it is clear that racial incitements are actually violent in nature and therefore put the chambers in danger should bring about consequences for the people who do these acts." Robo, who made the offensive comments, did suffer one major consequence when his radio show was canceled by the station on which it aired. But many believe that more action is needed to deal with future racial rants or threatening language. Attorney Corey Briggs says his client condemns speech that is intended to be intimidating, threatening, or hurtful toward others. But he argues in his letter to supervisors such statements can never be used to rationalize a violation of the law, no matter how objectionable the statements might be. Specifically, Briggs contends that changes restricting the public's right to ask that consent calendar items be pulled for full discussion violate the Brown Act and California's Constitution. Time limits imposed on speakers are too restrictive and thus patently unreasonable, according to Briggs. Briggs further argues that restrictions on the public's free speech violate state and federal constitutions, giving too much power to the chair to interrupt any speaker and be the sole arbiter of what is considered discriminatory or harassing remarks. Briggs says the rules were rushed through without considering how they might be applied by future chairs who might not be neutral in how rules are applied. Briggs says speech is protected legally unless it is a criminal threat or incites violence. He also calls language in the ordinance too vague, adding that the draft would not pass muster in a first-year class at law school, much less in a courtroom. Briggs' letter asks supervisors to confirm in writing that violations identified in his letter will not occur at the next meeting when they are slated to take effect. Failing to do so, he warns, will mean his client will, quote, pursue all legal and equitable remedies available. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Every 10 years, political districts at all levels undergo redrawing district boundaries to reflect demographic changes reported in census data. A statewide commission has just released preliminary maps of congressional, state assembly, and state senate districts, which must be finalized by December 7th. In addition, a county commission is considering draft maps for supervisorial districts, which also must be determined in December. Some East County leaders have voiced concern, though, over certain proposed maps that, if approved, could divide East County, lumping communities such as Lakeside in with coastal areas, and some places in with communities in other counties. Opponents include the Lakeside Chamber of Commerce, which supports alternative maps, as well as some political leaders in Santee, El Cajon, and Alpine. The stated intent of the law is to focus on trying to keep communities together based on factors such as shared cultural, ethnic, geographic, or economic concerns, voting rights, and more, and the process is nonpartisan. All districts must be approximately equal in population, be contiguous with compact shapes to avoid gerrymandering, and try to keep cities, towns, and communities together. But critics say by dividing East County, the proposed reapportionment does the opposite and could weaken East County's clout as a voting bloc. The most vocal concerns have been raised over proposed changes to supervisorial districts. Currently, all of East County is represented by two supervisors, Joel Anderson and Jim Desmond. The county's nonpartisan redistricting commission has proposed several draft maps, some of which encompass coastal communities along with East County, and one that would divide East County into three districts, each combined with urban or coastal areas, a move that some fear would weaken the influence of voters in rural, mountain, and desert areas, as well as communities such as Santee and Lakeside. Some plans would take cities such as La Mesa, El Cajon, and Lemon Grove out of East County representation and shift them into a densely packed urban district. Now, there are two additional meetings planned on the supervisors' maps before approval is required December 14th. George Barnett, a member of the Alpine Community Planning Group, says that all draft map options divorce Alpine from communities it shares much in common with, such as El Cajon and Santee. He also objects to the state legislative redistricting plan, which would put Alpine with Chula Vista and Imperial County, thus losing its political affiliation and power as a conservative member of an East County block within San Diego County, Barnett says. But it isn't just about politics. East County communities also share much in common when it comes to wildfires, agriculture, and transportation issues, including traffic on major highways that connect East County with the rest of the region. On November 10th, the California Citizens Redistricting Commission released its draft maps for congressional districts, which must be certified by December 27th. The state has to lose one district due to a population decline, but San Diego will keep five congressional districts. However, the boundaries would change so dramatically that new maps don't even list the district numbers. Three of the congressional districts proposed would border Mexico, including a district in East County, a central district, and a coastal district. A fourth district in North County would stretch from Poway east through Ramona and Julian, picking up those portions of East County, and north into Riverside County. The fifth district would include San Diego's north coastal region, and that would extend into Orange County. The change would shift Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs' district south, give Congressman Juan Vargas more of East County by taking Imperial County out of his district and moving it northward, and lop off the southern part of Congressman Darrell Issa's East County district by extending it north into Riverside County. Congressman Mike Levine's district could become more competitive, shifting slightly north into Orange County, as well as San Diego's North Coast region. But Congressman Scott Peters' district would have only modest changes. Now, as for state legislative redistricting, the commission proposes to provide just one huge assembly district for most of East County, including the unincorporated areas and the city of Santee. La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and El Cajon would be shifted into one of four districts in the county's center, an apparent effort to combine communities with high numbers of immigrants and refugees into just one district. There would also be two coastal districts, north and south. The proposed state Senate map would also divide East County. One district would stretch from Santee and El Cajon westward to the waterfront downtown. Another would cover most of East County and South County, as well as parts of Riverside County and Imperial County east to the Salton Sea, further diluting East County voices. A third district would stretch from central San Diego through inland North County, while the fourth would run along the coast from La Jolla north to Laguna Niguel in Orange County. The commission approved the congressional and state legislative map drafts, but the public can still submit comments at wedrawthelinesca.org or speak during virtual meetings coming up. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now is the time to sign up for health insurance or hunt for a better deal, as this year's Covered California open enrollment period runs now through January 31st. Groups that advocate for older Americans are urging everyone, including those who are currently insured, to check out the Covered California website, which says more than 70% of consumers who get subsidies could choose health coverage for less than $10 per month. Luis Campillo with AARP California says lawmakers increased the financial supports in the wake of the pandemic.
With the recently enacted American Rescue Plan, which increased financial help for ACA insurance premiums, there's certainly more Californians who may be eligible than in years past.
According to Covered California, an estimated 1.1 million uninsured Californians could get financial help to pay for coverage through Medi-Cal or Covered California, and 85% of them, or about 943,000 people, can get covered with no monthly premium.
For more information, go to CoveredCalifornia.com or call them at 800-300-1506. Campillo says AARP is also mobilizing its 38 million members to support a proposal to allow Medicare to negotiate to lower the price of prescription drugs.
Our e-activists are contacting their members of Congress to take advantage of this monumental opportunity, really, to help a lot of people who are paying a lot of money for medications that are available cheaply in other industrialized nations.
The plan to lower the cost of prescription drugs was part of President Joe Biden's original Build Back Better reconciliation proposal, but was dropped from the framework released last week and is in danger of being left out of the final bill. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement from the San Diego Humane Society. November is National Adopt-a-Senior Pet Month, and what better way to celebrate than by opening your home to a senior animal in need? All month long, the San Diego Humane Society is reducing adoption fees for senior pets 7 years or older by 50% to help these special animals find loving homes that they deserve. There are currently dozens of senior dogs and cats available for adoption at the Humane Society's facilities in El Cajon, San Diego, Escondido, and Oceanside. Senior pets often experience longer stays in shelters than younger animals, and yet these older cats and dogs have plenty of love to give and make for wonderful companions. Here are just a few reasons to consider adding one to your family. You can teach an old dog or a cat new tricks. Some senior pets are already trained, and even if they're not, they tend to have an easier time focusing than younger counterparts. They adapt faster. Mature animals are likely to settle into a home more easily and quickly than younger pets, often due to past experiences living in houses among people or other animals. What you see is what you get. Unlike adopting a puppy, there's a lot less guessing about what a senior animal's full size, personality, or required care will be. The information makes it easier to pick an animal that's the right fit for your household. These sweet seniors usually have less energy and require less exercise, which makes them great additions to mellow, relaxed households looking for a cozy companion. A senior pet will bring maturity and wisdom into your home, as well as unconditional gratitude. If you give a senior pet a chance, they will thank you for the rest of their life. Now, once you bring your senior pet home, proper care is important to making their golden years special. A healthy diet is essential for keeping your pet healthy and at a proper weight. Often a diet specially formulated for senior pets may be the best option. Like humans, pets often become less active as they age, but it's still important to keep your pet active with regular gentle play. Enrichment toys are a great way to keep your pet fit, both mentally and physically. It's important to take your senior pet to the vet regularly so that any health concerns such as arthritis can be addressed before they become problems. The most important care tip for your senior pet is to give them lots of love, affection, and companionship. If an older pet sounds like a good fit for you, there is no better time to adopt than during National Adopt the Senior Pet Month. Walk-in adoptions are available in November at San Diego Humane Society's campuses, Tuesdays through Sundays from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And again, those are located in El Cajon, San Diego, Escondido, and Oceanside. And you can also browse available senior pets online at sdhumane.org/adopt. Again, that's sdhumane.org/adopt. A coalition of legal groups representing asylum seekers say that dozens of requests for urgent humanitarian parole have been ignored for weeks by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, while others have been denied without adequate explanation. The applicants include individuals and families with life-threatening medical conditions. The ACLU Foundation of San Diego and Imperial Counties, Jewish Family Services of San Diego, Immigrant Defenders Law Center, Transgender Law Center, and the Al Otro Lado filed an administrative complaint in early November asking the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General to investigate. Some of the pending cases include an application filed on behalf of a family with a 3-year-old child who has urgent medical needs due to suffering from epilepsy and frequent seizures, another application filed for a family of 5, including a baby in need of urgent medical care due to having macrocephaly, intracranial hypertension, epilepsy, and fluid in the brain, and an application filed on behalf of a gay man living with HIV who is unable to access critical medications. After fleeing persecution in his home country to seek asylum in the U.S., he's been forced to wait in Mexico, where he continues to face threats to his safety and well-being, according to the complaint. People fleeing persecution and violence have the legal and human right to seek asylum in the U.S. However, using policies such as Title 42 and the Remain in Mexico program imposed by the Trump administration, the federal government has effectively shut down the asylum process. The U.S. Supreme Court has blocked efforts by the Biden administration to allow applicants to await their hearings in the United States. As a result, the humanitarian parole application process run by the Border Patrol is the only path for vulnerable individuals to access protection in the U.S. through the southern border. By failing to protect or summarily denying humanitarian parole applications, the Border Patrol has virtually closed even this narrow path to protection, the advocates contend. Monica Langerica, immigrant rights staff attorney with the ACLU, says people with urgent humanitarian needs are entitled to seek relief provided by United States laws. These protections are especially important for people fleeing violence and persecution. At a minimum, she says, the Border Patrol must give meaningful consideration to applications for humanitarian parole, which by definition are urgent and are the only remaining path to safety in the United States through the southern border. The federal agencies have not responded to media inquiries on this matter. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Are you hungry in Lemon Grove? There's no need to suffer in silence. Community members are invited to come to a drive-through food drive on November 20th at the Lemon Grove Recreation Center at 3131 School Drive starting at 9 a.m. Participants can receive food items including fruits and vegetables to help your family during these challenging times. In addition, 200 turkeys and trimmings for a hearty traditional Thanksgiving meal will be given away during the food distribution. Bring proof of residency in Lemon Grove and be sure your trunk has space available. Participants are advised to arrive early since supplies or some items are limited. This has been a public service announcement for the City of Lemon Grove.
This is Gerald Stevenson with the Health Report. To debunk misinformation about COVID-19 stated by some public speakers during county supervisors' meetings, the county has convened panels of local doctors. A session on November 3rd included doctors from Rady Children's Hospital, Scripps Clinic, San Ysidro Health, and Neighborhood Healthcare. It was moderated by Dr. Eric McDonald, the county's chief medical officer. Here are some of the facts presented by local medical experts. The American Academy of Pediatrics has strongly endorsed immunizing young children against COVID-19 now that the CDC has approved vaccines for children as young as 5 years old. Several thousand U.S. children have gotten multi-symptom inflammatory syndrome, or MSIS, from COVID, which causes long-term organ damage. Children are getting long-term COVID symptoms such as brain damage, trouble concentrating. 94 kids aged 5 through 11 have died of COVID in the U.S. There have been more deaths in pediatrics from COVID in the past year than is usually seen in a year from flu. Children are just as likely to get infected with COVID as adults and can transmit it to family members or others. Even a mild case of COVID means lost school time to quarantine, which can set children back in their education. No children have died of COVID vaccines. No cases of heart inflammation after COVID vaccines were found in any of the children ages 5 to 11 during testing. Testing found the vaccines to be extremely safe for children ages 5 through 11. The Pfizer COVID vaccine for children ages 5 through 11 is only one-third the dose that adults or teens receive. Misinformation resources and links to watch these videos in English or Spanish can be found at coronavirus-sd.com.
This is Miriam Raftery, and I'm here with John Fastier. This holiday season, if you're looking for some safe conversation topics to liven up your next gathering with friends and family without bringing up politics, here are some fascinating holiday trivia facts to share.
Candy canes are stocking stuffer traditions, but they were actually invented to keep children quiet during church.
In medieval times, the main dish served at Christmas dinners was peacock, not turkey.
Jingle Bells was originally written for Thanksgiving, not Christmas.
Christmas trees were once considered pagan symbols, but today 350 million of them are grown on Christmas tree farms in the U.S., where 98% of all Christmas trees sold are now sustainably raised. A Christmas tree grows for 15 years on average before it is cut.
The world's tallest snowman was actually a snow woman, standing over 122 feet tall. She was built by townspeople in Bethel, Maine, with wreaths as eyes, skis for eyelashes, tires as buttons, and trees for her arms.
According to the Bible, Magi, also known as wise men, brought gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the Christ child born in a manger. The term Magi derives from ancient Greece and Persia, where it meant magicians or astronomers.
The Magi reportedly followed the Star of Bethlehem. To this day, scientists are not sure what that star was. Possibly a conjunction of two planets, a comet, a supernova, or something else that lit up the sky.
The first electric Christmas lights to light up the sky were invented by Thomas Edison.
Hanukkah is also called the Festival of Lights. A menorah is lit for 8 nights and traditionally placed in a window to remind the outside world of the miracle of oil that burned for 8 days after rededication of a temple in Jerusalem.
Originally, the only Hanukkah gifts were small amounts of money known as gelt, a tradition that was designed to teach children the importance of charity.
The first Hanukkah party in the White House was hosted by President George W. Bush, a tradition that continues to this day.
The most popular Christmas song of all times, White Christmas, was written by Irving Berlin, a Jewish songwriter.
Americans spend 6 times more on gifts than food during the holiday season, but they are also more apt to donate to charities at this time of year.
Santa Claus would have to travel at over 5 million miles per hour in order to deliver presents to all of the children on Earth in a single night.
The tradition of making New Year's resolutions was started by the ancient Babylonians, who actually celebrated the New Year in springtime. The most common resolution was to return borrowed farm equipment.
Roman Emperor Julius Caesar established the Julian calendar that we use today, with January 1st as the first day of the new year.
Today, the most common resolution is to lose weight. Not surprising, since the average Christmas dinner in America contains over 7,000 calories.
Dropping a ball in Times Square to ring in the new year began in 1907 because fireworks had been banned as too dangerous. The ball has been a New Year's tradition ever since, except in 1942 and 1943 when it was canceled due to wartime restrictions.
The first ball was made of iron and wood, adorned with 100 light bulbs. It weighed 700 pounds. Nowadays, the ball weighs nearly 12,000 pounds and shimmers with 2,668 Waterford crystals.
All year long, visitors to Times Square in New York City write their New Year's wishes on pieces of confetti. At the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve, those wishes are included in over a ton of confetti that showers the crowd gathered to ring in the new year. And now from all of us at East County Magazine, to all of you, we wish you a very Merry Christmas, joyous Hanukkah, and a Happy New Year.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.